It's so important to wrap context around a number. If I said to you, Amir, is $1,000 a lot of money? Well, it's $1,000 for a pack of gum. It's nothing at all for a brand new car, right? Or a house, right? So, in absence of context, a number is meaningless. $1,000 doesn't tell us anything. The biggest obstacle to better pricing execution is not to be found in a spreadsheet, it's our own self-limiting beliefs. Our fears, our habits, our attitudes. It's okay to have options, but I would not just lay out the buffet in front of them and say, well, what looks good? Because then you're abdicating authority. You're abdicating expertise to someone who's trusting you to be the expert. The key in selling is to eliminate resistance and have it become me and you versus the problem. So if the problem is it's too expensive, let's me and you be against that problem. If we're in this sort of push, push, push tug of war, this is me versus you, right? And why I love questions so much is that what's so common is that people think that the right answer to a price objection is like an answer, and it's not, it's questions.
Welcome to The Show Goes On. This is a podcast about the people who keep the businesses running behind the scenes. My name is Amir Narani, and today I'm joined by Casey Brown. Casey Brown is a 25-year pricing geek with a passion to help leaders, entrepreneurs, and sellers command the prices they deserve. Her decades-long reputation as a pricing expert arose from pioneering innovative pricing content, formulating and executing pricing strategies, and driving dramatic, sustainable results. Her TED Talk has been viewed 4 million times. And Casey, that's actually my first question for you today. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Amir. Thanks for having me.
You had a great quote in the TED Talk, and you talked about how no one will ever pay you what you're worth, only what they think you're worth, and you control that thinking. I love that quote, and that's what I want to dive into right away. Can you expand on that?
Sure. I think it's commonly the case when people hear that I'm a pricing, you know, and by the way, for your listeners who might have think you called me a pricing geek, I call myself that. That's in my intro. So when someone hears me say I'm a pricing geek or someone describes me as a pricing expert, they often think that their questions and their answers lie with numbers. Like, let me figure out exactly what to charge. You know, let me figure out exactly what my competition is doing. Let's figure out exactly what the customer. The reality is the number is, I'm making up a statistic, but I'm a consultant, so it's allowed. Less than 50% of the problem or the challenge is getting the number right. I'm not saying there aren't challenges around that, but most of the problem is often the mindset of the seller, the 6 inches between our ears. The biggest challenge on our side is not the number, it's the mindset. And the biggest challenge on the customer side isn't the number either, it's the context. And this is what relates to your question, right? So it's so important to wrap context around a number. If I said to you, Amir, is $1,000 a lot of money? Well, it's $1,000 for a pack of gum. It's nothing at all for a brand new car, right? Or a house, right? So in absence of context, a number is meaningless. $1,000 doesn't tell us anything. And in too many companies or individuals who sell sort of abdicate the responsibility to really set the right context in the customer's minds. They kind of do this sort of, here's our value prop. They may kind of throw up some messaging that sort of speaks to the benefits of the product or service. But I think that is doing a disservice to their pricing power if they don't fully own the responsibility to help the customer think what they should think about the value of your product or service.
Okay. So how do you create that context? You were talking about that. How do you create that context in the customer's mind? What are some of the things that you can do?
Well, I think so. The answer somewhat depends on the industry, of course, and the nature of the sales relationship, right? If a customer goes and buys, you know, you sell headphones and you sell them on your website and people put them in the cart and there's never a conversation, that's quite different. If you're an EOS implementer and you're sitting down for your first meeting with a customer and kind of talk like, or you sell this, and really it very much depends on what you sell, who do you sell it to, and how the sale unfolds. But I would say by and large, the kind of companies that we are mostly helping are doing some kind of negotiated sale. In other words, there is a conversation between two people happening. And the key in that moment to help create the context is not to talk too much about yourself, is to really understand what the customer needs and what their challenges are, what headaches they have, what hassles. So the superpower for creating context is questions, like asking the right questions, asking enough questions, asking hard questions, so that you can really understand, you kind of widen the aperture just beyond your product or service to the kind of the the customer as a whole and what problems and challenges they face, and then thoughtfully connect. And that does a couple things. One, it informs you about how to connect the dots to your services. Two, it builds trust. It builds confidence in your expertise because the questions you're asking are really clearly thoughtful, and one's linked to the next. And so you just dive deeper. And the reality is people like to talk about themselves. So the more I talk, the more I trust you, oddly enough. So then we are able to build a bridge between everything they told us and what we do and how we do it. In other words, if your fast turnaround times is one of your, value proposition elements, but your customer doesn't even want to start the work for 6 months, that it's silly to harp on something the customer doesn't care about. And it's equally foolish to miss hitting a note that is really, really critical to them. You can't figure that out if you just jump out of the gate with a dog and pony show about your products and services. So I think context creation is really rooted in questions and then an understanding of how the answers thread together to the pieces of your products and services and value propositions that are actually going to matter.
So you talked about context creation and how a lot of that's rooted in questions. Already, I'm learning so much on this, and I'm curious, how did you get started in pricing? How did this come about in your career? Very curious about the origins of that.
Well, it wasn't the thing when I was 8 years old at career day, I thought, you know what, I'm going to grow up to be a pricing person. No, I didn't even know this was a field. I didn't know this was a thing. And if I had, I don't know that I would have been attracted to it on its surface. I wouldn't have understood how cool the area is. But like many careers, mine didn't take an exactly straight path. I found my way to pricing when I was a Six Sigma black belt at GE under old Jack Welch heyday, and did a rotation. It was a rotational program at GE, and I did a rotation because I'm an engineer originally, actually. So I have a degree in chemical engineering, and started my career in R&D and manufacturing as an engineer, but wanted to get closer to the customer, what they cared about, what was important to them, mostly because all the salespeople at my company were going to national sales meetings in Las Vegas, and 23-year-old me thought that looked really glamorous, and I wanted to understand what was going on in that part of the business. But I did a rotation in sales and a rotation in marketing, liked and learned a lot from both of those. But then I landed for a rotation in pricing and just kind of fell in love with it. I find pricing is the intersection of data and psychology. It's kind of art and science and people and process. And I just the order of pricing appealed to the engineering part of my brain, but the gray, the nuance, the mystery was really intriguing to me, and I got fascinated by it, and proceeded to have pricing roles of increasing importance in corporate America. And then about 15 years ago, decided I wanted to hang out my shingle and bring what I had learned in these large companies about pricing excellence to small and medium-sized businesses, and that's who we serve. So.
Okay. And that's what led to Boost pricing, right?
That's right. That's
Okay.
right. I was both convinced that the stuff I knew would help small businesses and disillusioned by sticking around in a corporate setting. I was kind of done with that scene. And so I thought, what's the worst that could happen? If my business fails, I can go get another job I don't love. And like, if where I land, if the worst case scenario is back here, I can, it's worth the shot. And then, 15 years later, I've never looked back.
I love that. Love that. So you said pricing is the intersection of psychology and science. Can you talk more about that? And I'm also curious, are there any influential pricing experts that or books that you've read or things that you came across that led you down this path?
So not so much on the literature. I've read a lot of pricing books. I like them. For me, I believe most pricing books are read for other pricing experts. I think there are few pricing books read for the lay person who is trying to get better at pricing, which is one of the reasons I wrote a book, actually. So my book's called Fearless Pricing, and it's really about the practical implementation of some of the concepts we're talking about here in a business, rather than, elasticity calculations and segmentation analysis with the p-value less than 0.05. A lot of pricing literature is really about the very technical, the very arcane aspects of pricing decision making. And it's not that that's wrong. It's just that every entrepreneur I know has their hair on fire spinning 100 plates. Like they can't, spend 17 weeks of time in an Excel spreadsheet to math this out. And I don't think math is really the answer anyway, as I kind of alluded to in my answer to your opening question, which is the biggest obstacle to better pricing execution is not to be found in a spreadsheet. It's our own self-limiting beliefs our fears, our habits, our attitudes. Too many people who are in a selling seat, whether it's a CEO of a company or a salesperson or a solopreneur who still sells, right? Whoever is in that selling seat, I would bet you if you line up 100 people who sell stuff and say, "What do you love about selling?" I bet you my house, zero of them would say, "I can't wait till I tell them the price tag. It's so fun." Like, nobody loves that. You don't love that. I don't love that. Nobody loves that part. It's not the fun part. The fun part is building relationships, solving problems, closing business, getting the customer to say yes, being the hero, like building relationships. The pricing is the necessary kind of evil that we go through to get where we need to get to, which is helping the customer. And that's the fun and exciting part. So even for very competent and confident sellers, pricing tends to be an area of relative lower competence and confidence compared to other things they're super phenomenal at. You know, before we hit record, you kind of confessed, "Hey, I'm not sure I've always been great at this either." I would say that's true for almost every business, maybe every business owner I meet, that they're wildly confident in the value of their products and services. They're, zealous on the topic of their value. But if I say, "Do you have the same level of confidence that your pricing's dialed in the same way you are that your product, your service is dialed in?" And they say, "No, nobody's confident about it." So why that all matters is if we show up to a selling conversation confident in our product or service, but not confident in our pricing, then we're that much more quick to discount and concede price in the face of pushback. And pushback is going to come because customers have other stuff to spend their money on. Even if they love you, even if they think your stuff is awesome, they're still going to push back because it's their job to do it. They got employees to pay for or other things to buy or whatever. So, this is my way of saying, kind of back to the art and science, most pricing decisions are made from a place of fear, not confidence. We're mostly pricing not to lose the deal versus pricing to win based confidently in value. And so while the science side or the data side or the process side is, can we get better at that? Sure. But the biggest problem is the art side, the psychology side, the people side. And that's where, most of the content I create, most of the talks I give on stage, most of the training programs we do at Boost are really around building the confidence and the skill set and the mindset of commanding the price you deserve.
Yeah, I love that. Pricing to win. So what's your stance? You just quickly referenced those discounts. I'm curious, just out of my own curiosity, what is your stance on discounts then?
Well, you could predict. I'm not a giant fan of them. I don't think that they're, just to, go a little bit more detailed, I don't think that there's no place in business for them. That's not my attitude. I don't think just because you're the best in your industry that you could charge anything you want, right? Like, you could sell the, world's best gluten-free raisin bread. You can't charge $150 a loaf for it, right? There's still a competitive range, and there still are strategic reasons, times, occasions, and reasons strategically to make a price concession. I don't think the right amount of discounting to do is zero. That said, it is overused. People discount too quickly. As soon as the pressure hits, that's their first tool. That's their first lever they're pulling. We can discount too quickly, too deeply. So maybe we didn't need to go down to 10% off. We could have gone 4% off. Go too broadly. In other words, we cut everything on the proposal down instead of just the one product or service that they're really the most sensitive about. So too quickly, too deeply, too broadly, and we do it from fear. And it's reasonable to feel fear. I think, as a person who built a business from nothing as a single mom with two kids at home, when somebody was putting pressure on me in my early days, I sit there and wring my hands like, "Geez, I really need this work." And we talk ourselves into it because we really need the work. We have a team to keep busy, or we have employees to pay for, we have payroll to make, we have families to feed. And we are, sit there wringing our hands and talk ourselves into less than we're worth. So this is all my way of saying fear is normal. It's just a terrible reason not to get paid what you're worth. So I'm not anti-discount. I'm anti-unnecessary and fear-based discounts, which I would say are 90% of the discounts that are given, maybe more.
Okay, that makes total sense. So you feel like fear is the primary driver, and then you talked about they haven't even touched on the other levers, and just go straight to the discount. So,
That's right.
in your experience, what are some of the other levers that, entrepreneurs can pull whenever pricing comes up
Well,
or
very
discounts?
often, and this almost kind of ties back even to your first question about the TED Talk too. Like, when a customer says this is too expensive, there's one of three things going on. The first thing that could be going on is this is a brazen tactic. They absolutely do not believe it's too expensive. They're willing to pay it, but they're hoping to use natural fear and intimidation that arises in a customer relationship to get you to discount. So one is it's not real. Like, second is they really believe it's too expensive and it's not. In other words, you haven't done a good job of creating the context. If they fully, they're not necessarily saying it's too expensive, they're saying it's too expensive for what I perceive I get. Right? And so that's again what our job is to make sure that they perceive reality, which is it's not too expensive for what you actually get. If you actually understood all the ways this is going to help you, all the problems it's going to solve for you, all the ways it's going to help you achieve your goals, that it would be a no-brainer. So that's the second case. First case, it's in a tactic. Second case, they perceive it's too expensive because they don't fully understand the value. The third is it's too expensive because they do not value what you're great at. Like, the problems your product or service solves, that the things it helps them achieve, do not matter to them enough to pay the price tag. In which case, I would say those are not your customers. Let them go bother the competition, right? So all three of these cases where somebody says the price is too high, almost always the discount is not the answer to it. So the answer to the first two, and actually the third, because we have to uncover if they're in the third case, is again back to salesperson superpower questions. When somebody says, Amir, I'd really like to go with this proposal that you've put in front of me. I have a high degree of confidence in you and how you work, and I'd love to work with you, but so and so down the street gave me a proposal for the quote unquote same thing, and it's 10% less. I'd like to go with you, but I need you to help me out here. You don't have to be the lowest, but you got to be in the ballpark. Could you do it for X? You've heard that. Everybody who's ever sold anything has heard something like that,
My first gut reaction is to say, like, yes.
Yes, right. Well, because we tell ourselves, let's say I'm making it up, let's say it's a $10,000 proposal, and they say, the guy so and so down the street said eight. You don't have to be at eight, but man, could you do 8,500? I'm never going to get my boss to sign off on this unless you can do 8,500. And we tell ourselves, well, 8,500 is better. 100% of 8,500 is better than 0% of 10,000, right? Or my boss is on my butt because I'm having a soft month, or I have not closed a deal in 3 weeks. I need this. Like, we talk ourselves into it. So the reality is we can't know which of the cases they are, nor help them clarify. Like, if it's this one, we gotta uncover the first one. If it's just a tactic, we gotta uncover it and politely and diplomatically hold the line. If it's the second one, we've got to help them understand the value. If it's the third one, we either have to decide that this is a strategic time for discounts, because they don't value it, we're never going to make them value it, and we're going to discount anyway because it's the right thing to do strategically, or we're going to show them the door politely and diplomatically. We can't figure any of that stuff out if we do all the talking. And too often, when somebody says, so and so down the street's cheaper, Amir, can you match this price? We rush in and we start talking. We do a number of different things. One is we match the price, kills our profit, or we meet in the middle. Kills our profit. Or we try to do some kind of apples to apples thing where we're like, well, let's talk about our proposal and their proposal and what's different, beep, 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 right? Or we vomit a bunch of value messaging at them. Problem with that is that's a dialogue, that's a monologue. We need to be dialogue, right? The mouth is running, the ears are closed. We need to kind of reverse that. And so I'm a big fan of questions as the first tool every time anybody ever gives you price pressure. Very first thing is ask them questions to understand what's really going on. Now, what questions you ask depend on your situation with that customer, what they're telling you. So, for example, the whole price match request thing we just laid out. Like, if you're being directly compared against another quote, you could ask a question like, let's just set price aside for a second. Let's just pretend these prices on these two proposals were identical. Who would you choose? Well, I'd go with you, Amir. Okay, great. Can you help me understand why that is? Like, so that when I come back to you with a revised proposal and pricing, I don't take away anything that you critically care about. What is it about me, our team, our process, our products, our services, our approach? Help me understand why we would be the choice if price weren't the factor. And then hush up and listen to the answer. And sometimes there's something that's trotted out in that conversation that you can pull a thread. And you can uncover that they actually have no intention of going down the street for that guy for 8 grand because he can't solve his problem. You can solve his problem. Now, I'm going to say something kind of obvious. Customers are not idiots, right? They're not going to trot out their pricing power and lay it on your plate. Like, well, they can't start until December and I need it by next month. And you said you could start right away, but they're not going to show their hand that much. But the key is to start the conversation. To begin an exchange where you can get information that helps you understand which category of customer they are and what your next move should be. We're never going to figure that out if we do all the talking. So that's one key lever. Like, it's always the first best one to pull.
You know, this, just a little bit off topic, this kind of reminds me of like something that Chris Voss talks about a lot in the negotiation book. I forget the name of it.
Never split the difference.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he talks a lot about how just getting them into a conversation instead of getting yes or no answers, getting the other person talking, because it just reveals more context, and along the way you hear about more things and something will stop.
100%. There's also a there's something. So I'm a brain science geek. I love like learning about some of the reasons behind the ways we behave and where we think we're making a decision, and actually we're just kind of programmed for things. And there's something called instinctive elaboration, which is where our brain is physiologically incapable. It gets hijacked by a question, and it is incapable of contemplating any but anything but that question for a moment. So, for example, if I said, Amir, what color is your shirt? For a moment, like a second, or maybe even less than a second, your brain was occupied with that question. Oh, my shirt's black, or wait, what color is my shirt? Or why is she asking me about my shirt color? Why that matters is you're not thinking about the next question you're going to ask me. You're not thinking about what you're having for lunch. You're not thinking about this podcast and when it's going to go, live. You're thinking about that question. Why that matters in a negotiation. And I think this is where my stuff and Chris Voss's stuff kind of, blend together a little bit. We have a lot of similar approaches. Is that, and his stuff is all rooted in hostage negotiation, right? The stakes are super high. In most of our cases where we're selling something, the stakes aren't as high, but the same psychology and the same human, neurochemical and neurological and psychological processes are at work. So what's often happening in a negotiation is it's this kind of game of push, push, right? They're pushing against you're pushing against them, and they're resisting you, and you're trying to kind of fight their resistance. The key in selling is to eliminate resistance and have it become me and you versus the problem. So if the problem is it's too expensive, let's me and you be against that problem. If we're in this sort of push, 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 tug of war, this is me versus you, right? And why I love questions so much is that if you say it's too expensive and I'm arguing with you about why it isn't too expensive, your resistance goes up, 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 up. You're feeling sold to. You're feeling like I'm being salesy, I'm being pushy, I'm being, right? If I ask you a question and your brain cannot be contemplating, I agree or disagree with her, or I think this, or I worry she's going to say that, or man, this lady's pushy, your brain is not thinking that. It is thinking about my question. That kind of like it drains all the resistance out of the conversation. And then if the questions, now this can be really dumb, right? Like you can annoy somebody really quickly with superficial and ridiculous questions. So it's worth putting some energy into this ahead of time and brainstorming on some questions. If they say this, what questions, what five questions could I ask? By the way, ChatGPT is awesome at this. If you want to like prep for a customer conversation, tell it the situation. Here's what I'm going to say. I'm worried they're going to say these things. Help me prepare questions that can help diffuse this. What's so common is that people think that the right answer to a price objection is like an answer, and it's not, it's questions.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I think that's what we tend to get into is whenever there's a negotiation going on, I know I'll do this sometimes, I'll start to panic. And then the first thing you run to is the easiest thing is, oh, okay, how about a discount? Or,
Right.
you know,
Anything
you
to just
just,
close the deal. Hurry up and close
yeah,
it. Yeah.
exactly. We're so
Well,
preoccupied with closing the deal.
I think, so some people that's their first instinct is almost like, let me just fold. Let me just, if this is an acceptable amount of folding, then I'm going to fold because that's the fastest, easiest way to a close. And then I can get back to the stuff I love. Other people, the instinct is to bat it back and forth. And I imagine like a, pickleball or badminton or something where people are just there,
A
and the
volley back
sale
and
is kind
forth.
of just going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and we're arguing, and the path I'm sort of laying out is, much more collaborative than argumentative, or and more collaborative than just fold and give up, right? Because the folding, there's some problems with folding. First of all, it costs you a bunch of money. Right. The other thing, and this is particularly important for people in professional services industries, you're asking them to hire you because you're an expert at something. You're asking them to trust you as an expert in something to help them solve a problem. Right. If you, how you kind of sell is how you do everything. How you propose is kind of how you do everything. If you are so unconfident in your expertise in the negotiation and you fold that quickly, I think it can really be damaging to the brand. I think it can really tell the customer you're not as good as you say you are. It can plant seeds of doubt about your effectiveness because you don't behave as a peer. The whole goal in selling, and I don't care what you're selling or who you're selling it to, is to sit at that table with some measure of, partnership and being a peer, not a peddler. We're not just like hawking wares. We're not just like begging the customer to buy our stuff. We're solving problems. And that's again true whether you're talking about services or products. Behaving as a peer means being willing to diplomatically and respectfully disagree or push back or ask questions. Oh, Jeremy, I'm so glad you let me know that prices, that my price is higher than competitors. I appreciate that information. Do you mind before I come back to you with a revised proposal if I ask you a couple questions so I can really make sure I understand what matters to you, how to da da da, da and then I can really, okay, now we're building trust. Now like I need to make sure that I don't put something in front of you, Jeremy, that does not solve your problem. So I need to understand this better. Like versus, yeah, I could do it for 8,000. Like it's also it kills trust when we drop the price too quickly because now it's like, well, how much were you trying to get away with there? What if I'd offered you six? What if I'd offered you two? Like where's the floor? It actually hurts trust when we cave too quickly.
Yeah, it erodes the value. And like as you're going back and forth right now, I was just like, man, if you were trying to propose something to me, I'd be convinced by the end of it when you're asking me questions, if we're going back and forth, I would say, man, I feel like she really understands what I need. So I'd
100%.
rather pay a little bit more because this is the company that's going to nail down exactly what I need versus the other company where I'm paying less, but they may not quite understand exactly what I'm going for.
Well, and now again, I don't mean to lean too hard into professional services, but this is so what you just described is so important. It's like, and I know you've got a lot of EOSIs as listeners of the podcast. You think like the day rate is the big topic of conversation between EOSIs, and my day rate's 6,500, my day rate's 8,000, my day rate's 10,000, my day rate's 3,500. There's all this. It's like when you sit down for a 90-minute meeting with an EOSI and you're experiencing a lot of pain in your business and misalignment and missed deadlines and lack of productivity and your numbers aren't great and you've hit the ceiling of complexity and all that pain is going on. Are you going to hire somebody else to be the EOSI because they're $1,000 less a day? Who doesn't get you? Who doesn't ask the questions? Who doesn't connect with you? No, you're not. That's not a savings. That's not a deal. It is not a deal to pay a pile of money to someone and not get your problem solved compared to paying somebody a pile of money plus a little bit more who actually does the work that you need them to do. And I think there's analogies to this in every industry, but we convince ourselves sometimes that, because we're 10% more, 20% more, or whatever than the other guy, and the customer uses that tactic to try to get us the discount, that they're a real flight risk. But I think when we've built trust, we can hang on to a price premium without much flight risk.
Yeah. And what you were saying at the end, right? Which is if they're just not into that, then you have to be able to allow them to walk away or
Let
show
them
them the
go.
door. You know, maybe it's
Yeah,
just
if.
not the right client for you
Right.
because they're more hung up on price rather than truly capturing the value that they
Yeah.
would get if they went with the right company.
I think that's worth kind of a double click on and talking about a little bit more because there are real budgetary limitations. Like, so for example, some businesses we work with sell to nonprofits and they're saying, like, oh, nonprofits don't have the budget. And I am not here to argue with the reality that the budget limitations can exist. And so I would say, if you're a business that sells to a very budget conscious segment of the market, do you have an offering that's sized for that segment of the market where you're not, maybe they don't need all the bells and whistles. Maybe they don't need, all the way up here, the primo version. Maybe they don't need platinum. Maybe bronze is just fine for them. So sometimes the answer to the price sensitivity, the price sensitive segment of your customers is through your go to market and your product and service design. But beyond that, I would say, like, sometimes there's a difference between someone who has a real budgetary limitation and someone who is like obsessive about pricing, not because of budget, right? Like, there are people that are just like, there's no number you're going to ever tell them that they're not going to argue with. And I talk about this in my book. My older brother's this kind of guy, and I love him. He's probably outside of my immediate family, my partner, my kids, he's probably the person I'm closest to on this planet. But he is one cheap son of a gun. And you could tell him, if you were an EOSI, you could say, my day rate is normally $8,000, but for you, Scott, we'll do it for $1 a day. And he'd say, I don't know, man. That sounds kind of pricey. Can you do it for 50 cents? Right? Like, there are people for whom negotiation is a sport, it's a game, right? And then there's other people like if you and I everybody who's ever sold anything has experienced people that like there's just like no getting through to them about the value. They're just no getting th there's and I would say when somebody is hyper and by the way my brother will pay for value. He's cheap. He tries to get a deal, but he believes in value. But if you've got somebody sitting across the table from you that is like there's almost nothing you say. It just bounces off. They're like Teflon and all that, like they're just a price nut. To me, that's a red flag. I'm not saying I wouldn't sell to a person who's very, very price conscious, but I would want to understand, hence questions. I would want to understand if we're really a good fit or not. Because a lot of times the most price sensitive customers really don't connect with your value. They don't value it. A lot of times those end up being the worst customers ever. They abuse your staff, they suck up disproportionate organizational resources, they don't pay you on time. They're a nightmare to deal with, and you're sorry you ever took them on as a client. So sometimes hyper amount of price sensitivity out of the gate is a red flag to me that maybe this is somebody that isn't a good fit for our core values, and
Yeah,
they're
I
going to
love
be a
that.
tough client.
I was just reading something Alex Hormozi wrote the other day, just on one of his social media platforms, and he said, "Dear younger self, I wish you would know that your lowest price customers would be your biggest headache." And
Yeah.
I was like, "Well, yeah."
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard to walk away from business. It's hard to turn it down. I know this very, all too well personally. You can't be in business for, a decade and a half and not run into the seduction of taking on the wrong business because the dollars are really, boy, we could really use that money right now. But in the long run, and not even the long run, sometimes in the short run and often in the medium run, it's very clear we made a bad decision. That it actually costs us, like the calorie burn inside an organization of dealing with a terrible client is like, if you'd have reserved that organizational capacity to solve problems, better your operations, sell another client, accomplish anything, you'd be miles ahead of where you are chasing around this terrible client who just doesn't even value you anyway.
I love that. What you just said about the calorie burn in an organization, I've seen that far too often in companies I've run and just in others too, where you get the client, you get the dollars, but how much more energy are you expending throughout the organization? And
Yeah.
everyone's, going on a wild goose hunt. And is
Right.
it really worth it then? Rather than the smooth business that's actually paying well and you feel like it's right up your alley.
Well, and you're speaking to the intangibles because sometimes people want to point at the gross margin or something like that. It's like, well, we got a good gross margin on that. And it's like, yeah, but let's look at the true cost to serve. Let's look at that calorie burn. Let's look at the fact that, Sarah and accounts payable had to call them 11 times to try to get the invoice paid, even though their invoice is smaller than most of your giant clients who pay you timely. Or, like across the organization, what are all the ways this is costly to us? And if you could really kind of have clarity around that, you would have gone back in time and not had them. Now nobody can go back in time and say no to a deal we should have said, or say no to a deal we should have said no to. But I think we can learn from that, and that can inform our future negotiations and discussions. And I think getting clarity around what's a good deal and what isn't, what's a good client and what isn't, what's a good price tag and what isn't, and having that clarity inform our decision making and have us be willing to say no to bad business is one of the. It's such a power move. And it'll do it to exert, it's not about having, a flex, right? But it feels great to be on a call with someone who you can just see from 1,000 miles away is going to make your team's life horrible. And then just to say, hey, I really appreciate the time to talk today. I feel like we're not a fit. Here's the reasons why. And, if you ever want to talk again in the future, I'm happy to re-explore this. But based on this and this and this that you're telling me, I think we're probably not a good fit for you. So thanks for the time. Hang up, move on. It feels amazing. Take yourself out for lunch.
I love that. Yeah, you have to be able to stand your ground sometimes and like you had
Yeah.
said, position yourself as a peer rather than a peddler,
Yeah. Yeah, this I think every sale is a mutual qualification process, and too often the seller imbues the buyer with too much power, and they are trying to sell the customer on them, on their products, their services, them as a salesperson, right? And I think like we got to be the buyer too. Like we're buying something also when we sell. We're buying a relationship with the person and the company across the table and all that comes with it. And let's be discerning as a buyer. Dan Sullivan, who Strategic Coach founder, has a little mini book. He's I'll always be the buyer. And I think that that's just essentially, it's not about arrogance to me. It's just about sitting in your, kind of sitting up tall in your chair as a peer. And I also think, again, back to professional services, nobody's hired because they want somebody to, nobody hands you a giant check because they want you to agree with them. That is not why people hire us. That's not why anybody's ever given Boost a check, is so that we tell them they're so smart and everything they're doing is perfect. It's so that we can say, here's some opportunities, here's how we can help you. And sometimes that means sort of pointing out the, kind of pointing at the warts, the flaws. But if you can't operate as a peer in a negotiation, then you're going to struggle to be as effective as possible in the actual client relationship.
So, as an entrepreneur, I think one of the things you've experienced this, and I'm sure I have too, we want to be able to charge the higher prices or charge a price that we feel is in accordance with our services. And there's probably sometimes a sense of imposter syndrome that, oh wow, now they're willing to pay the higher price. Now I have to deliver. So
Right.
how do you balance that where you finally do get the right customer and they're willing to pay more, and all of a sudden this wave of imposter syndrome hits you and
Yeah.
you're like, oh crap, now I have to actually provide
Yeah.
services that are in accordance with that. What if they don't think it's worth it? I mean, am I
Right.
even doing this the right way? Like, how
Yeah.
do you coach entrepreneurs through that?
Well, I think so. It's super, super common. I'm a truck driver's daughter from the wrong side of the tracks. And I remember not that long into entrepreneurship, the first time I proposed a deal that was more than my father had ever made in a year. Right. And it was going to be, a handful of weeks of a project for me and my team. And I just was like, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to, my dad was the only, my mom stayed home with us. So he was the only, like, our whole family lived for a year on this amount I'm about to ask this person to hand me, and I'm just, who am I? I'm just this truck driver's daughter from the wrong side of the tracks. I'm just this, poor kid who's playing dress up, trying to get people to listen to her. So even, the quote unquote expert on this stuff, it affects all of us. There are times we have moments of doubt, and I would say, to me, acknowledging the fear, acknowledging the doubt, but not letting it define you and not letting it stop you from following through. Now, as it pertains to the kind of the particulars of it, so if you've made big promises, then you better deliver on those, right? But I don't believe if the spectrum is, on one end you have people making giant promises and they can't deliver, and the other end is we're making small and medium-sized promises and we're over-delivering by a ton. It's the second of those that's the bigger problem that I see in my client base, the EOS community, other these are best in class and better in class companies. They're really doing an exceptional job. Do they, fumble from time to time? Sure, but when they fumble, they make it right. They turn, they go to the ends of the earth. They jump over, jump through hoops to try to make it right. So, in my experience, even though we may feel that imposter syndrome, if you look at the reality, you look at your customer testimonials, you look at the results of past projects, you look at, the results are there, they're more than there. Like, if you are routinely under delivering on your promises, you are not in business for any length of time at all. You will not last. You cannot last under promising, or sorry, over promising and under delivering. So I would say that acknowledge it, look at the proof to the contrary, and then get to work and do great work for your clients.
I love that. Like you had just said, acknowledging it and then just get to work,
Yeah, put the shoulder down,
deliver.
push against the wheel. I mean, what is she going to do? Just work
Yeah,
hard. Do
exactly.
great work. And my experience, and this is a little bit more about this business community we both are part of and serve, is that when you are in a best in class organization, and that could again be an organization of one or a whole team of people, you stop noticing how special the work you do is because it's just what you swim around in every day, right? Like, it's just this is how it is. And it reminds me of the story of the, these two young fish swimming along in the bottom of the ocean, and they're talking about this pretty young fish they just saw. And this old fish swims by and says, "Hey, boys, how's the water?" And they look at each other and say, "What's water?" Like, we're so close to our own businesses, our own processes, our own deliverables, our own value proposition that, like, day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out, excellence starts to feel kind of like not that special. But down the street, they're not doing excellence. They're doing okay, pretty good, sometimes pretty great, mostly kind of mediocre. Like, so I think it's worth maybe kind of coming up out of the woods and or out of the weeds and looking around a little bit and kind of reorienting on how much value there really is here. Too much humility can actually work against us here. I wrote a blog once, and I can share it with you if you do show notes, about core values driven companies, which, great, ideal, of course, that's what we want. But if either stated core value or an implicit value is humility as a company, that can be, I mean, those are lovely people to be around, but they're often underselling their capabilities and as it relates to price, and it's really costing them money. So I would say don't be too humble.
Yeah, I love that. I wrote down two words right before you started saying the word humble, and I wrote down paranoia and humble because I feel like those two traits, amongst many traits, are the ones that help you start the business, get it going, and then keep it going because you have this
Yeah.
sense of paranoia that, okay, I can never rest in my laurels.
Right.
Yet those are two things that may hold you back from charging what you really feel
100%.
like you're worth.
100%. On the paranoia front, I think and I just look back at the first couple of years I had this business, and I mentioned I was a single mom, two little girls at home. Didn't ha I mean, no family nest egg, no trust fund, right? Like I am on my own, and the urgency and the almost the fever of like I got to get business, I got to hustle, I got to and you know, it's the only way the kids were going to eat. It's the only way the mortgage was going to get paid. And I think founders in particular carry almost like it's almost like a PTSD from the early days of the business that like can really infect our decision making as the business matures and we sort of grow beyond the need for that level of paranoia, and we're established and we exist in the market. People know us and they trust us and they come back to us again. And there's no need for that level of fear-based decision making, but it's just like it's still with us because we remember it. Or the first time, you know, when you had your first employee or two or three, and it's like just making payroll, it's so much pressure that it becomes a habit that we can't say no. When somebody wants to work with us, we can't say no to a client who's willing to hand us a check, even if the check they're trying to hand us is for the wrong kind of work or they're the wrong kind of client. And so I think it's worth, if you haven't, you know, gotten this by this point, like very little of this is about math, right? Mostly pricing stuff is about inspecting our own beliefs, interrogating our habits, really pulling back the curtain on our own decision making and asking ourselves, is this really the right thing to do?
I guess kind of like how you perceive yourself and then creating that perception for others as well.
That's right. That's right. And almost again, all my clients tend to they like if you have a terrible product or service, pricing is not your problem. Fix your offering, right? But that's not who comes to me. That's not who runs on EOS, right? These are not people that are in our business sphere. Their crisis is not that they aren't good enough. Their crisis is that they don't believe they are.
So one of the other things I'm always seeing beyond just professional services is the concept of, and this probably does apply to professional services from time to time, is the good, better, best pricing. What are your thoughts on that? Is that something that's still worth paying attention to? I'm curious.
So yeah, it's this is exists on both products and services. I just had a call with a client last week that was it's a consulting firm, and they always lay out three proposals. And I was like, why do you do that? And I ask a bunch of questions. But I would say that there are times, places, reasons to present options. Like the fact is, back to kind of more brain psychology or human brain, you know, science. We love choice. Oh, we love a choice. It gives us a dopamine hit. You know, do you want to? That's why when my kids were babies, I would always be like, you know, do you want to put your pajamas on before dinner or after dinner? Like, you're putting your pajamas on, but I'm giving you a choice. So you have this
Smart.
illusion of control, right? So I think, and we have been sort of enculturated into this idea that it's good to give options. Like, the good, better, best is good. And they'll always pick the middle. And we're told these things. And I would say that there's very little science to back it up in the B2B space. Like, there's just not. Some of that kind of optionality in the B2C space, there's a lot of interesting science in the like in consumer and retail that and you know dining and stuff like that. But when you're talking about a business selling services or products to other businesses, is there a reason to do good, better, best? I would say sometimes yes, but because we love choice, but too much choice paralyzes us. And it can kill the decision making. And if you think about like if you go to buy a car this weekend and you know what make and model you want, there's probably maybe three trim packages, right? There's the L, the XL, and the SXL or whatever, right? And they have curated for you what's in those packages. So the you know, one cautionary piece of advice I would offer to anybody who's thinking about, you know, good, better, best or tiers or whatever is don't make a million of them. Make a couple, make a few. Three is a great number, not 11. But also have a point of view. And what I mean by that is if you've done your homework, and by homework, I mean asked enough of the right questions, and you know what the person sitting across from you actually cares about and wants and needs and what success looks like in their world, then you already know which of those solutions is the best one. And it's not always the best, by the way. It might be the better, it might be the good. And so it's okay to have options, but I would not just lay out the buffet in front of them and say, well, what looks good? Because then you're abdicating authority. You're abdicating expertise to someone who's trusting you to be the expert. So you might say, we have a few different ways we work with companies to solve this problem. You know, at a very high level, here's what those three are. The one that I think is the best for you is this middle one here. Let me tell you why I think that's the best one for you, and answer any questions you might have about it. And if you feel like I've missed the mark on scope or budget, and one of these other ones makes more sense, let's take a look at it. Now you have led them. You have led them. And I think that's super important when they're trusting you. And again, whether it's a product or a service, you need them to trust you.
I'm learning so much in this right now. Like, I'm just like, wow, Lord, that was a genius way to talk about how
Thank
instead of
you.
just giving them the buffet, you lead them
Yeah.
down that path and position
Right.
yourself as the expert.
Yeah, well, it's all about trust. And
Yeah.
I'd say, so for example, at Boost Pricing, we have more than this, but we have three ways we work with teams by and large, three different ways we work with teams. For oversimplifying it's a good, better, best model. I don't, when somebody, almost always, they want to get on a sales call. We get on a sales call. They say, what do? What do you sell? How do you work with teams? And what do I say? I am delighted to take you through that. But before we do you mind if I ask you some questions? And then 3/4 of the call, we spend talking about them, their business, their sales teams, their products and services, their competitive landscape, how they price today, what they're frustrated about, all that stuff. And then I don't present three. I present one. That's how I do it. Now, I'm not saying you should never present. If you do present, some have a leadership position, have a point of view. But I present one and I say, based on everything you've told me, the best one for you is this one. And then I only draw back and punt if they push back on it. And they say, look, I'm concerned about the time commitment, or that feels over my budget, or I'd really like to do something with all my people in person. Or like, if they tell me something that says this isn't a fit, then I say, okay, well, here's an option that I think is, I didn't hear that before. I'm glad you clarified that. Let me propose something else to you then, based on what you just told me, that I think is still going to give you all the benefits of that first program we talked about, but is also going to require less time, is also going to be in person, or is also going to be more budget friendly, whatever. So I take the point of view thing so seriously that I don't present them all the options, because I am the best equipped to know. That said, I'm willing to pivot if I need to. So I just think it's important to lead them.
And if you're spending 3/4 of the call building that context, asking questions, then too, you're informing yourself rather than saying, oh, we do this, we do this, we do this. They may not even care about any of that.
It's just too dog and pony-ish to just talk about your stuff. You know, it's like people love to buy, but they hate to be sold to. You know, they love
Agreed.
to buy, they hate to be sold to. And when and they've reached out for the call, they've expressed some genuine interest in what you do, and then they ask you. But then we can turn them off so quickly by kind of getting into this like let me trot out all my stuff and impress you with all how cool my stuff is and how smart I am. It's like the best way to impress people is to like thoughtful questions and good listening. And then connecting the dots back to how you can help them.
This sense of independence that you have where you're just going to go out there and figure it out, raising your daughters and doing you, where did this come about? Like, where did this trait in you come from?
Well, I was always, I never thought I would ever be an entrepreneur. Like, there's people that have their stories where it was like, I had my first lemonade stand at 6, and I, you know, like, that was not me. I, you know, was raised in a family that lived below the poverty line. And my parents were always really big advocates of education. So they were always talking about going to college, and that's the ticket out, and, you know, go to college, ticket out. Cool. Those phrases were repeated in my home about 1,000 times a year. So my highest, and all the plans I had was go to a good college and get a good job. And that's as far as my plan went my entire childhood. And then I got a good job, and I got, you know, promoted and promoted, and I got another good job and promoted and promoted. And I mentioned this before, I started to be pretty disillusioned with what I saw in giant corporations. There are a lot of inefficiency, a lot of bad in short-term decision making, a lot of self-interested people doing, you know, playing politics, and I just got frustrated about it. And my brother, meanwhile, same brother that we've been talking about, he had been an entrepreneur by this point. He bought into a business, and then he started another business, and he was just kind of swimming in that pool. And he wasn't like many entrepreneurs. Like, they try to recruit everybody into entrepreneurship. It's like a, you know, a little cult. He just wouldn't shut up about it. It's like, Case, you got to do it. You got to do it. You love it. Case, Case, Case. And I started to form some ideas of what a business would look like, but to be perfectly blunt, I was afraid. I was very risk averse. My life did not, like, I didn't have a safety net. I didn't have a plan B, and I was like, what do I do? And then I read, and it's funny that this book was the the tipping point. I wouldn't say it was the genesis of my entrepreneurial journey. It had already started, but the tipping point was the 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss.
Yep.
He has this one, and there were plenty of things in the book I didn't love, but this one thing he said in the book about how people don't take action a lot of times in their life because they're afraid of something unspecified. But if they went to the effort of specifying it, getting really clear and specific on what those risks really look like, that we would take action. And I realized I had been avoiding taking the leap because I was the single mom with two kids, and oh my gosh, and I'm not, it's, if the business fails, we're going to be homeless and my kids are going to starve. And it was like, when I sat down and I started to really get like very specific about what would happen if I started a company and it failed, it was like, well, I burned through some savings, maybe go into a little debt, go get another crappy job I hated at some company I hated, which is like, that's what I already had. So if the worst that happened is I landed right back where I started, with a little bit of financial runway to rebuild, that was a terrible reason not to try. So that was that. And, since then, it's not been a straight line. It's not been all up and to the right. There's been plenty of challenges, plenty of heartache, plenty of, blood, sweat, and tears, but I wouldn't trade it. I'm absolutely ruined for conventional employment. If I could never have a boss again. I love the independence of it and the autonomy, but I also love value creation. Just feeling like I have the ability to, we kind of talked about like, put your shoulder against the wheel and push, just work hard. Like when I was in a giant corporation, I worked really hard and it couldn't move the needle. The needle was like unmovable. It was like if I did the most phenomenal job on the planet, there'd be an extra hundredth of a penny on the share price, right? It was like as a terror, it just didn't feel great to me. And it's like, I don't know, I'm a big person of analogies. So I think of like if you're in a big old bus and you push down on the gas pedal, how long does it take to get acceleration versus a Ferrari, right? Like being an entrepreneur is like driving a Ferrari versus, putting the gas on the bus. It's just nothing like it.
I've never heard that line before, but it is so true. Being an entrepreneur is like driving your Ferrari. So you're
Yeah,
right. I
it's
mean, there's,
terrifying.
yeah, oh,
A little dangerous, but so exciting. It's so cool. Yeah.
Oh man, this is amazing. I feel like I've learned so much today. And like I told you at the beginning, before we even got on, I was like, I'm excited because I am awful at pricing, and this is going to be amazing learning for me. So selfishly, this was awesome.
Well, thanks. I find it really fascinating. There aren't more of me running around. Most people have never met a pricing consultant. They don't even know it's a thing. And I say that because every business on the planet does it. And most of them don't do it particularly well or don't believe they do it particularly well or both. And so I think, like, I love this stuff. I love talking about it. I'm so grateful you invited me on. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope some listeners get some benefit out of it, because it's one of the most important things you can do in your business. X percent increase in price has a bigger impact on your profitability than X percent increase in sales volume or X percent reduction in expenses, but it gets the least focus and attention. And I'm just out here beating the drum trying to get people to pay more attention to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're doing a wonderful job at that. And before we sign off, is there anywhere that our listeners can find you, anywhere on the web?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a lot of places. So first of all, like the kind of in the I think of this by price tiers, obviously, like what can I get for Casey for free? Well, I'm on a lot of podcasts and I always post my podcast appearances on LinkedIn. I create a lot of videos and write blogs and that's always all posted to LinkedIn. I have a YouTube channel. The blog is you can subscribe to the blog on boostpricing.com. Also do a lot of keynote speaking, and so if any listeners are members of associations or on a programming committee or want to bring a speaker to their event, caseybrown.com is where all my speaking assets are. Also have a book called Fearless Pricing, found at Amazon or anywhere books are sold, paperback, audio, hardcover, and ebook. So any way you like to consume your content, I read the audiobook, so it's my voice. If this voice annoys you, don't do the audiobook. If you like the way I sound, then pick up the audiobook. And then for somebody that really wants, maybe to explore whether this kind of content for their team, they would be interested in a service or something, you can just reach out on our website and book a call and we can explore together whether we could help. But one of the reasons I wrote the book was about reach. Just I think that there are 30 million businesses in this country, small businesses, and we employ half of America, and most all of them could do a better job with pricing. And no matter how many companies hire Boost, we're not going to get 30 million clients. So I want to get the word out and get, free and low cost resources out to the business community. And that's why I put a lot out.
Love that. Thank you so much, Casey. Really appreciated your time today.
Thank you so much, Amir. It was great.